But this did give us a more precise structure building process, and we could make, and some of the resins that they still make are made that way by predetermined amounts of the monomer dye. But this amphoteric character is very visible because the number and the kind of groups changes the relative acid base character of the silicon. And I think I've got that pretty well explained here, whether it's with alkali. For instance, with alkali, the monomethyl forms a water-soluble salt that's it's reasonably stable, like sodium silicate. The dimethyl is a different animal, and if you try to make the dimethyl salt, say you take hydrolysate, you'll have two phases, and you can make the salt, but if you try to dissolve it in water, you'll get a disproportionation, and it'll oil out until the concentration of alkali in the aqueous phase is enough to make a very strong alkali, make the monomer salt practically, see? Mm-hmm. Which means that its acid character is greatly diminished by that second methyl group. You go to the third one, and it's quite a job to make, say, potassium trimethyl selenoate. It's quite a job. You have to work at it. And it's very easily hydrolyzed. And the sodium, they're all in that area, or in that order, the alkalis. Lithium, sodium, and potassium, their ionic character varies, and it shows up in attempting to make siloxane derivatives. And then on the acid side, we studied that equilibrium, and there's quite a lot of information in here about that. Silicon tet, of course, the equilibrium would be way out in left field. I don't think anybody's ever made silicon tet under pressure with HCl and sand. Of course, with the fluoride, I got some ideas about that could be used, but then the monomethyl is that we could calculate, in that one paper, we can calculate the equilibrium constant for some of these things because of work that was done by the people in the infrared area. I can give you that. That's funny, just offhand my mind's on these other things. We could find it later. But when you get to the trimethyl, the disiloxane, you can run HCl in there with a drying agent to pick up the water and convert it quantitatively back to the chloride. That's how distinct the amphoteric character is. Some of this probably is attributable to the silicon atom is a little more less rigid and a little more flexible than carbon. Maybe you could put it that way. I call inductive effects. But so that's important, that aspect of it is important all through the polymerization and depolymerization process. It's because a mono forms a more stable salt that you can chase out all the other dimethyl siloxane and use that as a purification. We've made polymers where the molecular weight was probably up around 500,000, and the viscosity up to 10 million or so. This is another thing that's in one of these. I think you can have some of those. I think I've got some left of like this one, for instance. This is that Whitehead lecture that I gave.
Oh.
I've got two of them, and they can. You see, this is a pretty good. Here's what you can do by NMR. You can tell the shift. In other words, the hydrogen on a silicon, on a methyl group on a silicon, the line is shifted. If you've got a three or four atoms, in other words, and. Where in the world is that other? I thought there was another page here. Oh, no, here's the one I was... This is an interesting thing, too. One of these is... this is the probability distribution curve against viscosity, against molecular weight, or I think that's molecular weight they got there, or DP. And this is a monodispersed one. It just parallels at a different viscosity. If you would want to take one.
All right. Sure.
I'm tied up there.
No, it's okay.
I was not a very good organizer saving some of these things. Now I regret that I didn't pay a little more attention, put them together in a halfway systematic manner, but I didn't think that way about it. I was more interested in what's ahead and what's back, I guess. So that gets us to...
I wanted to ask you one more thing about the war. What effect did the war have on your group in terms of personnel? Did you have any changeovers, and did that create any problems?
Well, I tell you, one of the things that came up and Johansson and Torok, excuse me, got involved in this when they started moving up through the jungles. A lot of their radios and communications things started failing. And in fact, somebody wanted insulators on submarines. Salt shorts out their aerial. So one of the things they wanted was water repellent material. So there was we started a research project that involved Dr. Johansson and Mr. Torok, which involved treated mainly Pyrex rods to follow and see what humidity and salt exposure did to them, in the process of trying to develop a material that would water repel the components in some of these communications things. That was another one of the projects that got started in the war. Well, we had probably about 15 people towards the end. We did have another person that came in that worked on lubrication. I wanted to see if we couldn't relate lubrication to structure of the molecules that were underneath it. And I believe you could. We built an inclined plane that we could put a jar in. We had a hemispherical rider. And we looked at all of the disiloxanes that had a phenyl and a methyl group in it, in them, and you could see changes in the coefficient of friction with the structure. I don't know that we ever did anything with it or amounted to anything, but that tilt took you directly into a sliding friction without this overcoming this initial slope, you know. And it was a good method. But we never really made good use of it. But we did have people working on this aspect of the thing, hoping that we'd find some unusual lubrication behavior. And
when your group, when the war ended, did that group of 15 stay that way, or did it?
No. We lost them by various means. You know, Bob Fleming had a lieutenant's. He'd gone to the ROTC. He used to teach down in, he's from Lawrence, South Carolina. Whether he taught high school, I'm not sure. But he came up to Cornell to get an advanced degree, and I think he probably, where he went to school down, I don't know what university, but he had a ROTC lieutenancy. And, of course, he was with us about a year. And he did wear glasses, and actually he was colorblind. And when the war broke out, it wasn't but a week later, he got a notification from the New York district to report. Well, he says, and that was on a Saturday, or Friday, I guess. And he says, well, I'll be back Monday. They won't take me with my glasses and my colorblind. Monday morning, I got a call from him. He says, I'm in the amphibian command at Fort Edwards, that's up in Massachusetts somewhere. So we lost him for the duration of the war. And then Joe Domicone got drafted. He was Joe Domicone had his bachelor's degree, but with a major in chemistry. But he got drafted, and I don't know what route he followed, but he came out a captain. He was involved in this Bulge thing, Battle of the Bulge. He managed to live through it. He stayed at Kearney. He didn't go out to Midland with us. So he was kind of their source of zircon information. When somebody around Kearney needed some information, they went to Joe. So we didn't see him again until after the war either. And of course, it's Johansson moved out to Midland, because here, I can't tell you the date, but it was, they were beginning to turn out some rubber compositions, and Johansson knew a lot about, he had the insight into this polymerization business, and so he went out to Midland first, and I've forgotten what happened to Torok. These people had other interests, of course, at Kearney, so. And, of course, our patent department, we had both Blackburn and Dr. Lee Fowler in our patent department looking over and taking care of patent work. Dr. Fowler had his PhD in organic chemistry, really? Too, before he went to law school and got to be a very, very nice people they were.
When was the decision made to move your group to Midland?
Well, it was really piecemeal. I think that Dow Corning was paying my salary for quite a while before I moved out there, really, but Johansson went out. And then about a year or two later, Dr. Doubt went out, and when Bob Fleming came back after the war, he wasn't with me very long before. Bob was a very meticulous person, and he had a very good mind. And these guys out at Midland, they grabbed him for the patent department. So Bob spent most of his time since he got back from the war at the in the patent department out there. Actually, he was in the Pacific area. He was one of the engineers that went in and made a good landing place for the rest of the army, I guess. I don't know. It wasn't, but he lived through it.
Did your group then get smaller as these people went through?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot now what I wound up with. Maybe three or four people. As soon as the war was over and we started moving things to Midland, and there wasn't, I didn't have to go to Midland, but I could see so many interesting things that still needed to be done that I couldn't very well resist the temptation, all of the raw materials and the things you need for research were all right there, So it didn't make sense to... I get back to Kearney now once in a while. They like to have me come in. I'll get down, and they pay me a kind of a little consulting fee, and it keeps me a little bit from going completely stale. So I get down there and try to help them with problems. I don't know whether I do or not, but I always had in mind, I hope we come up with something good that Corning can use. Most of the time it hadn't been that way. But now with this optical fiber thing, I think Dow Corning finally came up with a good coating for it. They need a coating, and it has to be fast curing, all this kind of stuff. And I think the Dow, it was one of the 100 products of the year, I think. And what did I do with that? I have a... just a minute,
Okay, I'll turn this off.
Any great number of patents and publications that have it had to be up in the thousands now. This is I don't know whether they give me another one or not, but this gives you an idea of the growth. And here's this optical fiber thing.
Oh, all right.
That's one of their big items.
Maybe what we can do, I can borrow that and copy it and send that back to you
okay.
Also. That might be the easiest.
And in the back, I think they have, this is the gaffer. This is another... Yeah,
This,
when I saw that, I thought, why in the world don't they have something in there about the number of patents?
That's an excellent idea.
And this is another one of these gaffers. That's a guy, this is some of the spools of...
Oh, yes.
How they can get a laser beam 100 miles and get anything out the other end without that's the segment of their business. So, I guess that. But if you'd like to take that,
I'll borrow those and we'll return them. Take them along. And we'll copy what we need.
Gosh, they must have these.
I'm sure we can get a hold of those.
Well, I've forgotten now where we're at, but.
Well, we were talking about your move to Midland.
Oh.
And I was curious, you sort of indicated that you didn't have to go to Midland, that you could have stayed at Corning.
Well, it was a decision that I had to make. I think that Dr. Sullivan, I guess he was retired by then. No, I don't think so. He was chairman of the board or something. But they might have liked to have me stay. I don't know. But I saw so much that was interesting to me that I had just about had to go, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Warwick had already gone.
McGregor
had gone.
Just previous to that, yeah. I'm not sure just what Mac and Earl, of course, I don't think they got involved in the research. Mac. I knew Mac, before he went to, I knew Mac at Illinois.
Oh, really?
I didn't know him real well, but he got his degree working for Professor Beal And Beale and Braley, both out of the analytical department in Illinois, after Mellon built this new building, they both went to Mellon, and Mac went with them.
I see.
Mac got his degree working with Dr. Beale.
I see. Okay.
And I'm sure he was on some other fellowship at the time. Dr. Beale's main interest was in toxicology, I think, and whether that was Mac's area, I'm not sure. I don't know that much about it, but Mac got his doctorate, I think the year before, I think in 27. I think it was in 27. So I knew him personally, but I didn't really know too much about his, what he was working on or...
Well, when you got to Midland in, what, 51, I believe?
Yeah.
What did you do then?
I was a little disappointed. Hadn't really gotten the building finished where they were going to have a research lab that I could take over. And so I was a little disappointed. I had a little trouble getting organized and started again and things. And of course, then I got acquainted with Dr. Berry and Dr. Hunter and the other people at Midland, which was good. And I think I probably spent quite a bit of time trying to plan what I did want to do. And it is a kind of a disruption, you know. And and they didn't have the place ready. And trying to work with other people's tools or in other people's area is not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do. So I probably lost a little time. I sometimes think back now and think of a lot of interesting things that I could have gotten done and didn't, you know. The research is that way, though, of course. Then we started building up the group there as soon as we had the building where we could start some work. And this was when, the dates confuse me a little bit. Paul Brown came to work with me pretty early in the game, and we have quite a few patents together. And one of the things that we were looking at was he actually had started in the analytical laboratory there, I think. Then he came over to work with me, and hydrolysis behavior and you get some blank spots along with the. Maybe next week I'd have a little better picture of it. But then I had this idea of a continuous polymerization. I had a chance to hire an engineer named Jack Worley. He came to work with me, and we built this continuous polymerizer. We did... We made pilot plant quantities of polymer, you might say, and then we let it go. But I got interested in the. Seemed to me that we a lot of our products were going into an emulsion, and it just seemed to me that we ought to make a polymer emulsion. And we were able to take, say, it was a disteryl dimethyl ammonium chloride, actually, that we used. It's a pretty good emulsifier for the starting material, that is the siloxane starting materials, intermediates, hydrolysate, or whatnot. But then, we of course, the quaternary bases are they're strong bases like sodium and potassium hydroxide. And so what we did, and Jack Worley worked with me on this, we made it ammoniacal, which generated enough of the free quaternary base to form the siloxanol salt in the siloxane phase, and it worked beautifully, and we still make a lot of emulsions that way, I think. And Dr. Weinberg and his group were coming along. I can't tell you all about the work that they did, but they were working in the direction of making room temperature curing systems. And his group came along with the anionic emulsion. Of course, we were using a cationic emulsifier, and they came along with lauryl benzene sulfonic acid and the salt of that. And that gave an anionic emulsifier, and it also, on the acid side or on the alkaline side, would take you up and give you a nice emulsion polymer. So we had it on both sides. Usually, if you got an anionic emulsifier and you try to use it in a cationic system, they'll clobber each other, and vice versa. So there's good use for having both of those materials, and they're making good use of it. And that gets back to the products. You know, when the war ended, the only product we had was DC4 sealing compound, and Uncle Sam the only customer. That, they had to really squirm. And Charlie Sanford, one of the salespeople, knew about the products that they were having in the rubber industry. They were having quite a bit of reject. You know, it only takes 1 or 2% of rejects in the size of that business, and you've got a lot of wasted tires. And he knew about this problem, and we already knew that it was a lubricant for rubber, and it didn't mix with these other things. Compatibility is another one of the unique and important properties of some of these things. Well, anyhow, he sold the idea of treating the molds with, an emulsion, and that turned into something good. And I think Charlie Sanford was the one that got it underway. He and Ole Blessing were the two mainstays of our sales department way back then.
Were you talking to anybody outside of the company during the Corning or the Dow Corning?
No.
You didn't have any external consultants that you...
No, I felt that I'm part of the company, you know, mm-hmm. and there's nobody else that has anything to do with it.
Well,
another thing that we did at Midland, of course, was study this equilibrium hydrolysis. And that turned out very good. It gave us it more than ever emphasized the equilibrium nature and the amphoteric character, and the change with amphoteric as you change the groups. You could take the hexamethyl disiloxane and the hexaethyl disiloxane, and the equilibrium constant is different for the two, just because you change the groups there. That's a pretty easy one. Then we did study and that's another thing that Paul Brown and I did. We studied the equilibrium hydrolysis of the dimethyl. You can put dimethyl hydrolyzed, even though they always had trouble with N groups, so you get rid of the last monkey business of chlorine. They didn't understand why. They'd wash it, but they never, and then some of the products it was bad for. And what we did, we showed that if you put aqueous concentrated HCl in with dimethyl siloxane, it wouldn't matter what polymer you started with, hydrolysate or high polymer, whatnot. If you put that under high pressure, put an aqueous system, but put the HCl pressure up to a couple hundred pounds, you can take that all the way back to practically dimethyl and the dimethyl.